From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's 2017, and the Trump administration has hit the ground running. So we wondered whether or not regulations related to food and farming will also be on the chopping block. We called Helena Bottomiller-Evich in Washington to find out. She's Politico Pro's senior food and ag reporter. I know it's tough to predict what our new president will do, so let's start sort of at the top of the USDA with Sonny Perdue as his pick for new Secretary of Agriculture.
Yeah, Sonny Perdue has been nominated to be Trump's Secretary of Agriculture, but he probably will not be confirmed until later this month. You know, he won't have a deputy secretary. He's going to have several hundred positions underneath him to fill out. So it's going to be a little bit of time before we know who the key players are. And because Trump doesn't have any record on food or ag policy, who he selects for those positions is going to be really key.
So the fact that he's selected Sonny Perdue, what does that tell us? Tell us a little bit about this man.
Yeah, so Sonny was governor of Georgia from 2003 to 2011. He, back in the day, was actually, like many Southerners, was a Democrat. Now he's a Republican. I think most people consider him to be sort of a conventional agriculture pick. He's very familiar with food and farming issues. He's run a couple of different farming transport businesses in Georgia. Some of the food and farm reform advocates have hit him for receiving some subsidies over the years. But he's really just viewed, I think, as a conventional sort of run-of-the-mill status quo pick.
Given that under his purview, there will be a new farm bill, there are going to be a lot of issues that good food advocates will be looking at. Can you take us through some that you think we need to really keep a close eye on this year?
The farm bill is going to be really the prime topic of debate, I think, going forward. I think it's safe to assume that this administration is not going to be as active or activist on food and farming issues out of USDA. So the farm bill, which Congress writes, is really going to set the tone for the policy going forward. I think there's going to be really big focus on making sure that crop insurance, the subsidies that farmers get for crop insurance, is tied to conservation. There will probably be a big push to have even more support for the fruits and vegetables or so-called specialty crop side of the farm bill. So trying to sort of level the playing field there. I think a lot of people in the food movement are interested in that. I think promoting things like farm to school will be key. And actually, farm to school is one of those issues where there really has been strong bipartisan support for expanding that. The farm bill in general is going to really have to focus on retooling the safety net for farmers. The last farm bill was written during a time when crop prices were high and farmers were doing really well, and things have really swung in the other direction. And so, you know, without getting too into the weeds of different peanut, cotton support programs, I think there's going to be a lot of debate about how to better design those programs so that farmers aren't going out of business and really swinging back and forth between hard times and good times like they really have been.
Now, famously, food stamps sits in the farm bill. Are you anticipating that that is the part of the bill that will become the most politicized and partisan?
The food stamp part of the bill is always, or SNAP, as it's formally known now, is always a lightning rod issue. I'm sure many of your listeners are aware that there's sort of this grand compromise or coalition that's been formed that really brings together the farm state interests and the urban interests that are very interested in making sure that the food stamp program continues to be there for whoever needs that, whether they live in cities or rural areas. It kind of varies year to year, but I think right now it's between 75 and 80% of the funds in the farm bill actually support SNAP. So nutrition is by and large the biggest portion of funds there. Last time around, there was a conservative Republican effort to pull the bill apart, to have the nutrition part of the bill and then have the farm programs part of the bill. That effort ultimately failed. And I think most people in the agriculture community and the nutrition community are very committed to keeping the farm bill together so that it can go forward and kind of maintain its bipartisan rural-urban support. I imagine that there will be another attempt to rip the farm bill apart. It remains to be seen whether or not that will be successful.
Given the general public's extreme interest and galvanized activist tendencies so far, this short time into the new administration. Do you think that it's going to be an opening for the general public to sort of wrap their heads more around the farm bill than they ever have?
That's a really interesting question. There's certainly been an awakening, particularly on the left side of the political spectrum, to, you know, political activism and protests and getting involved and making donations. And, you know, it's an interesting question whether or not that would sort of translate into food and ag policy. I think stepping back right now, there's a general feeling of there's so many other really controversial, big news and political events happening right now, from the executive order on immigration to looking into voter fraud to, I mean, name the tweet of the day that's causing outrage. There's so many big news events that I think right now food and agriculture policy is just, you know, really under the radar. There's not a whole lot happening as the administration sets up its team. We'll see if it kind of remains under the radar or if it blows up like many of these other issues have.
So speaking about a passionate subject that causes heated reaction on both sides, the soda tax, where do you imagine that's going to go this year?
That's definitely one of those issues that I think this year and in 2018 is probably going to pick up more momentum, particularly as cities and states look to get revenue. The mayor for Philadelphia was in the office a couple weeks ago, and he was saying that his staff had been contacted by many other cities and local politicians that are interested in looking at this. Along that same line, and also going back to the food stamp issue, one of the kind of wild card debates, I think, for this year will be whether or not Congress or certain conservatives or certain Republican states will push forward trying to take soda or chips or other junk food out of SNAP. It's one of those issues that sort of sticks around and has been lingering for a while and every once in a while kind of comes up. It hasn't gotten any traction. But I think if some Republican states like Maine and Arkansas is actually looking at this right now, if they try to experiment with banning junk food from SNAP, that could open up a really interesting national debate about nutrition and the role of nutrition assistance and, you know, what rights people in poverty have and whether or not we should stigmatize them or whether those policies do stigmatize nutrition assistance. And that's definitely one to watch.
In an administration that seems to have its eye well set on cutting and cutting some regulatory aspects of government to save money, where does the issue of food safety oversight sit?
I haven't heard any proposals kicked around about cutting food safety. It's obviously kind of a risky thing to do. You know, if you cut food safety and then we have some sort of disaster, it could be, on top of being a public health issue, it could be a political liability. I think the concern going forward is if Trump's executive order on regulations goes forward, and that executive order basically just said if any agency wants to propose a regulation, they have to find two to cut. I think that is probably going to slow everything down kind of to a halt. Anything new going forward is probably going to be very difficult. That said, the Obama administration has just put out many major food safety reforms, and those are already finalized and already going forward. So it seems unlikely that those will be retooled at all. I think, you know, in general, the Trump administration has kind of bigger fish to fry than working on food safety reforms that were just completed in the last few years.
Have you been talking to farmers about how Trump's immigration policies will affect their workforce?
Yeah, immigration is one of those things that throughout the campaign, I mean, most farmers that we talked to, and I think polling shows this, supported Trump. And we often would bring up immigration. You know, how do you feel about his rhetoric on immigration? Does that concern you? Because a lot of farmers, particularly in specialty crops or dairy, are very reliant on immigrant labor. And a lot of those workers are undocumented. But throughout my reporting on this, farmers would say things like, you know, I don't like the rhetoric. I think he'll move to the middle. He's a businessman. He understands the need for labor. And I'm not sure how much of that will bear out. I mean, certainly Trump understands the need for labor, but I think some of his recent actions have made people quite nervous about what direction he's going.
What about the White House garden? Do you think they're going to rip it out?
Yeah, I've been meaning to go check on that garden. If I were to predict, and I really hate to be in the prediction business because things are just hard to predict, I don't think they're going to rip that garden out. You know, Melania isn't even moving into the White House till June at the earliest, if she even moves to the White House. There's a lot of people speculating about that. But, you know, the Park Service is actually in charge of the grounds, and they're the ones maintaining it. So
that gives me hope.
Someone would have to make a decision. And again, I think they've got more things on their plate than to worry about that. And the thing about the garden is the culinary staff, they have incorporated it into their planning, into their menus, whether it's the state dinner or the family dinner. So it would be a departure for them to change course on that. But, you know, I hesitate to predict because I don't know.
So now I have to ask you, we covered Trump's outlandish Taco Bell tweet on Cinco de Mayo last year. What do you make of his relationship to food?
I did kind of a deep dive on this a couple of weeks ago. He has a very interesting and varied kind of record on food and his food preferences. He certainly made fast food a key part of his image during the campaign, which was very interesting. You know, he tweeted that picture of himself eating a KFC fried chicken bucket on his jet. He'd Instagram a picture or tweet a picture of him eating McDonald's. Or, you know, he would talk about kind of being the everyman in that way. But if you go back, I actually went back and found one of his books from 2002 or something. I think it's called Think Like a Billionaire. And he actually has a section in there with the help of whichever ghostwriter he was working with. And it's on food and having a healthy diet. And he describes what he calls the Mar-a-Lago diet. And it's basically less processed, lean protein, you know, with fruits and vegetables. And he talks about how he needs to adhere to that from time to time, or his waistline would be, I believe it was, quote, an absolute disaster. So, you know, over time, he seems to have crafted different images about himself and food. And I'm not really sure where his real preferences are and really what that means. I know the New York Times had a piece the other day that mentioned, you know, Obama's favorite snack was almonds. And now they're stocking Lay's potato chips and Doritos. So I don't know if you can take away a lot from that.
That's Helena Bottomiller-Evich, Politico Pro's senior food and ag reporter. Find the link to her latest stories on our website. In local news, the LA City Council just voted to legalize street vending. Though it's been against the law for decades, thousands of undocumented immigrants have been risking deportation to sell hot dogs wrapped in bacon, fresh produce, and of course tacos all over the city. Sarah Portnoy's new book is Food, Health, and Culture in Latino LA. We asked her for a street food history lesson, starting with the tamale wagons of the 19th century.
Well, you mentioned the tamale wagons that roamed the streets between, say, 1870s and 1910. There were over 100 of them. So if you were a traveler migrating by train from, say, the Midwest, which is where a lot of people were coming from at that time, around the late 19th century, turn of the century, you get off the train, you don't have a lot of money, there's a cheap, good, quick meal for you from the tamale wagons. And so they were very popular, even though the city, just like with the street vendors today, did their very best to try to get rid of them, outlaw them over and over. But they didn't succeed. Eventually, they just faded in popularity by about the 1920s.
If we go beyond tamale wagons into a more sort of restaurant-based or even stand-based cuisine, when did Anglos here first become interested in the cuisine, which enabled a sort of shift to a restaurant environment?
So some of the oldest Mexican restaurants that we have today are from the 1920s. That are still in existence, El Cholo, El Coyote. And interestingly, they're called Spanish Cafe, El Cholo Spanish Cafe. Why? Well, back then, just as unfortunately today, there were negative associations with the term Mexican because they certainly weren't serving Spanish cuisine. They were serving Mexican food. And they were serving northern Mexican food from Sonora because that's where the immigrant population was coming from or that had already been there until the time of the Mexican Revolution. So they would have been serving food with steak, arrachera, flour tortillas. And it wasn't until 1918 that we have our first taco that made its way into Southern California. That was because with the Mexican Revolution, between 1910 and 1920, migrants started coming from central Mexico. We had over 1 million Mexicans that left Mexico and came into the United States, and many of them stayed.
Sarah, how did you get interested in covering the intersection of food and immigration in LA?
So I moved to Los Angeles in 2007 from San Francisco. And originally my background is in literature and folklore. I worked on ballads, which are poems people sing that tell a story. And I did field work around Cuba and Mexico. And as a poor grad student, ate my way through the market stands of all those places. But anyway, once I moved to Los Angeles, I started listening to this radio show. And one day I was driving down the street listening, maybe 2009 or so, to You'd Have Your Weekly Chat with Jonathan Gold. And somebody called in and asked him if he considered Tito's Tacos, the famous Los Angeles institution right here on the west side, to be authentic Mexican cuisine. And his answer was that you can consider the cuisine of Los Angeles to be a region of Mexico unto itself. And I pulled over and I said, what is this man saying? It seemed like blasphemy to me at the time. But as I started to learn more and more about the Latino food culture of the city, I developed my own views on authenticity.
Which had become more expansive.
Yes, I went with the Gustavo Arellano camp of authenticity, which is anything a Mexican touches or a Latino touches is considered Mexican food. Maybe not to that extreme. Gustavo likes to take things to the edge, but I definitely acquired a wider definition of what could be considered Mexican food and developed my own theories of authenticity along the way.
What restaurants do you think have made the greatest contributions in terms of elevating Latino cuisine?
Carlos Salgado's Taco Maria comes to mind. I think it's done a great job of putting Southern California on the map so that when somebody like Enrique Olvera comes here, he says, Enrique Olvera is the chef of Pujol, which is the most famous, or one of them, in Mexico. And so when he came here, now chefs like him are coming to Los Angeles to try our Mexican food. He said, Southern California, Los Angeles has a Mexican cuisine just like Oaxaca has its own Mexican cuisine.
I love him for saying that.
Yeah, I was like, yes, we made it. Once he said that, if somebody who's an outsider like that is saying it, then you know we've made it.
Yeah. Gentrification is such a big topic here in Southern California. How has gentrification of traditionally Hispanic neighborhoods affected cuisine?
Politically, for example, there's a phenomenon that we have in Los Angeles of the loncheras. Loncheras serve lunch. Now they serve much more than that. And they're parked in fixed places. They're all around the city, right? But there are tons of them dotting the streets of Boyle Heights and East LA.
They used to be referred to as roach coaches.
Correct. And I think some older generation Angelenos may still refer to them that way. But luckily, their image has changed for the better recently, I would say, thanks to our what Gustavo's christened our Lux Loncheras, the Kogis, and so on. But let me step back. So in 2008, as Boyle Heights and to a lesser extent East LA was beginning to gentrify, Gloria Molina, who was then the LA County supervisor, had an ordinance passed that they could only park for 60 minutes in a commercial district, which is basically a way to eliminate their business. And that was because the area was going through a process of gentrification. Luckily, a judge overturned the ordinance a couple of months later, and the loncheras have thrived and are much more secure today. But we see a lot of gentrification, and it has hopefully a good side to it, too, in that it's exposed more of the Anglo or the non-Latino market to Latino cuisine.
I always feel like that's the first step, though, to ultimate gentrification. People get curious about eating somewhere that isn't in their neighborhood. They go. Then young chefs see that it's a neighborhood where you could get space for much less money.
Mm-hmm.
The adventurers start first and go. And then soon it's real estate and displacing people from homes. It's such a double-edged sword.
Right. It's all tied up together. Yesterday when I was talking about my book, I was talking about as a result of gentrification, many of the community gardens that were able to open in these vacant lots because the areas were not gentrified then got kicked out or in the process of being kicked out because the area is gentrified and now the property is way too valuable. So it all is tied together. It's tied up also with cultural appropriation.
Yeah, I think it's always been a piece here in Southern California, that tension. How do you think Latino food has influenced the cooking of non-Latino chefs here in Southern California?
I think it's influenced the fusion that we're seeing more and more. Look at Roy Choi. When you see the kimchi burritos and when you see all different kinds of places that are integrating all different cultures into their cuisine, that's a result of the omnipresence of Latino cuisine or primarily Mexican cuisine throughout the city.
Has the expansion of Latino food and the haute cuisine, the Alta California cuisine, as Bill calls it, and the popularity of chefs like Ray Garcia, Wes Avila, Carlos Delgado, has it created a disparity between a higher-end dining experience versus what is available to many urban low-income Latinos?
So that's basically the thesis of my book. I started out just teaching about Latino food culture and taking my students to visit taquerias and pupuserias and markets and so on in East L.A., Boyle Heights, and beyond. As we went around these different neighborhoods, I would see, wow, there are a lot of liquor stores and corner stores where when you walk in, the first thing you see is many different kinds of chips and the hot taquitos and sodas. But I'm not seeing a lot of grocery stores. I'm not seeing a lot, too many farmers markets. That's getting better. But so I started to see this incongruity, this disparity between what is available to these elite chefs, the Wes Avilas and so on, and what is available to the Latino residents of South L.A., Boyle Heights, East L.A., and any number of parts of the city.
Do you think that the agricultural background and the rural background of so many immigrants who have come here, and that that background is so close, it hasn't yet gone through many, many, many generations of becoming urbanized. Do you think that it lends itself to a more nuanced nutritional way of eating for low income as opposed to other communities who may be more distanced from that past?
I think so, when they have access to that food. With every generation that immigrants stay here, they adapt more and more to the SAD, the standard American diet. Yes, with that first generation that comes and hopefully their children, if they have access to fresh, affordable, culturally appropriate foods, then they will maintain to a great extent the diet of where they came from. And hopefully that will improve more and more as we see the expansion of community gardens.
That's really fantastic. Are there any other food justice initiatives that are occurring to promote access to healthy, affordable food you want to talk about?
The Market Match program, that's pretty new, and they're available at over 30 farmers markets now in the city. That's through Hunger Action Los Angeles. And they provide you the ability to double the money that you have available to spend at the farmer's market. So that's a terrific program because originally most people conceived of farmer's markets as pretty elite. You had to have the money to be able to go and buy, you know, $4 a pound peaches and so on. That's not available to everyone. But now with that program, there are more and more opportunities for low-income residents to shop there.
And in fact, as you see that program expanding in Los Angeles and more markets taking place, you can see a change in the markets in terms of the vibrancy and the diversity of the people attending the markets.
Yeah, I guess it depends which market, which part of the city that you're in. But if you, when I take my students over to the Central Market, it's just about a mile from USC, between USC and downtown, I think 95% of the people there are Latino, and maybe 90-95% of them are using EBT to shop at the farmers market. So that program is basically supporting that farmers market, and they offer at the same time nutrition classes and cooking classes at the market.
I have to ask you this, because lately there have been a few very pointed essays that have been written about not only who gets to cook certain foods, but who gets to write about certain foods. Have you run into any backlash for being a white woman who's documenting Latino culture?
Luckily, I guess I've done a good job of reaching out to the community on so many different levels, so that when my friend Bill Esparza introduced me at my book talk yesterday, he said, even though she's an outsider, we consider her one of our own. You know, she's working with street vendors, she's working with and brought her students over the years to tour the loncheras all over East L.A. and Boyle Heights. So we will still take her in as one of our own. So that was a very proud moment for me as a gabacha.
Sarah Portnoy's new book is called Food, Health, and Culture in Latino L.A. She also teaches at the University of Southern California. Up next, we talk Super Bowl snacks, but we're not just talking chips and seven-layer dip here. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. The Super Bowl goes down on Sunday. Chips and dips are typically the first to arrive and the last to leave any Super Bowl gathering. Somehow always, meat manages to crash the party. There's no better way to emulate the defensive line than with a nice selection of sausages. Los Angeles Magazine restaurant critic Patrick Q is here to tell us where to go to stock up. I don't think I ever could have predicted that you and I would be talking about Super Bowl food in any form.
No, I mean, it's been truffles and caviar in the past. But I've been eating quite a few good sausages and buying quite a bit more than I really needed. And it turns out LA is a great sausage city.
Are there a particular kind of sausage that you think are perfect for Super Bowl? Do they have to, like, sort of play the role of a hot dog, like be inside a bun?
It depends on your level of commitment. I mean, touch on the subject of any sausage and there's controversy. I mean, the brat itself is full of controversy. Do you poach it first and then grill it? Do you only grill it? Do you grill it and then keep it in a beer hot bath, which is a culinary term in Wisconsin? The hot dog itself, which is the best hot dog. I've had some incredible all-beef hot dogs. Why not break loose and have a vice first for the Super Bowl? There are no rules. All sausages are relatively inexpensive, and it's actually a great opportunity to explore.
Is your default sautéing with water or grilling?
Okay, there's been so much written about how to cook a brat that I called the source. And the source is Fritz Usinger in Milwaukee, whose family has been making brats since 1880.
I would say that he's an expert.
So because I'd read do it this way, I'd read do it that way, I said, okay, let me talk to an expert. He has a two-beer method for cooking the brat. That is the time it requires to sip casually and enjoyably two beers while your brat is cooking on the cooler part of your grill. If you put it over the hottest part, you incinerate it. And as he said to me, if the casing breaks, game over. So it's all about keeping the juices that develop within the casing. So he does not poach at all. Now you have to be sure to get the temperature to 150 degrees Fahrenheit to have a completely cooked sausage.
I think this requires a lot more attention than many people will have. There has to definitely be a designated person for that.
In that case, poach first, color second. You'll want the flavor of the grill to be the last thing. Bratwurst, after all, comes from the word braten, to roast or to fry. And Wurst, of course, is the German word for sausage that invites all sorts of puns. A bratwurst that doesn't taste braten.
Roasty toasty.
It's a weisswurst, which you poach. Poach first, grill second.
Okay. We have so many new butcher counters here in LA these days. And we have a pretty good number of butchers, small specialty butchers, hidden here and there. Where do you like to go for your sausages?
There's two in Glendale, Shriners and Continental Gourmet Sausage. There are two classics. It's the German school of sausage making. Hot dogs, larger ones, which are the Knackwurst. They've got extra hot Polish sausages, usually called kielbasa. Continental Gourmet Sausage, I saw jalapeno cheddar wurst, which made me recoil for a minute until I tasted it.
Yeah, I know. It's the kind of thing where you feel a little bit of shame buying it, but then you eat it and you go, oh, no, this is really good.
It's been true to all sorts of traditions. And then European Deluxe Sausage Kitchen on Olympic. Gary Traub is the Fleischmeister, and he makes a whole range of Hungarian, Polish, and German sausages. But he also has an incredible sideline. In fact, he's the destination for the South African tradition of sausages. He makes a jerky called biltong and a dry sausage called drawwors and even a grilling one called boerwors. And so you go in there and it's full of South Africans buying their sausages. While we're on Olympic, we can't really not mention Marty's, which is a hot dog stand. But they have a combo, which is the burger with the hot dog on top, a Vienna sausage hot dog. That'll cure what ails you on certain days.
So that's if you can't wait to get home.
Yes.
And what about the larger places? Like, I found that I return over and over again to Huntington Meats in the farmer's market.
Yeah. Huntington Meats has a great selection. They're known for their sausages. They have a wonderful lamb sausage. San Marcondes also has pretty good meats, which is across the Huntington Market. There's a guy around town called Chori Man, which he's worth giving a shout out to. And he's been written about in a few places, Umberto Raigosa. And he makes Zacatecas-style chorizo. a loose form chorizo. You can saute it in a skillet with eggs. But his chorizo is, dare I say it, artisanal. I mean, it really is in the best sense of the word. He uses guajillo chilies. They dry on the plant. And he says that that brings a special element instead of drying them on big trays. And he sort of makes this, it's an adobo, but it's not a Filipino adobo. It's not a stew. It's sort of vinegar and guajillo chilies. And that's sort of the seasoning for his chorizo. You can find those at the downtown farmers market by the wholesale flowers market between 7th and 8th on Wall Street, Saturday mornings. And so Chori Man, Humberto Raygosa, if you want Zacatecas-style, good, robust sausage, he can cook it for you there or he can sell it fresh to go.
I have to say that I would take that sausage, saute it, and I would pour it into queso.
That would make you very popular at the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Oh, another place that's great is Belcampo. There's a couple of Belcampos around town. They have a whole range of sausages. And this is from cattle, like free-range cattle in Northern California by Mount Shasta. I mean,
they're vertically integrated. So it's like in L.A., I think it's the most humanely well-sourced meat opportunity.
And they have an all-beef frank, which is really terrific. Has all that snap that you want from a great sausage. They also do a Chicago-style hot dog with all that kind of neon glow fixings. And it's not really that expensive. You know, sometimes I think because of all the care that's gone into raising these animals, it's like $10 for a large pack of all-beef hot dogs. And that's kosher also, actually.
Along the way, have you found any halal options?
I have. Sausage, halal, merguez is the first thing that comes to mind.
And the lamb-based sausage.
A lamb-based sausage. There's a market called West LA International Market on Venice, like near Sepulveda. They do a lamb one and they also do a chicken one. I'd never heard of chicken merguez. It's a little bit lighter, but it's nice and fiery. And actually, they served them at the kebab joint / hookah lounge next door with plenty of harissa slashed on the roll and harissa on the side. So you could order them to go and take those to your Super Bowl party.
So if people are listening to this and they're like, okay, yeah, this is all fine for the Super Bowl, but now I just want to go have one of these sausages and and eat, where do you recommend?
Okay, one place that I really like, it's called The Wallace. It's in Culver City, and Chef Joel Miller is doing a fantastic job there. It's like a gastropub running on all cylinders. And so you'll do a lamb merguez, but rendered in the oven with a lot of Aleppo chili. He sort of folds that into a farro porridge.
Ooh.
And he serves that in a kind of small skillet. It's just a fantastic modern rendition of a dish interpreted by a young chef. Not far away, The Cannibal is a great butcher and restaurant, one of these kind of places that you were talking about. And Chef Francis Derby, they just love meat, like thinly sliced Benton's ham, then great kielbasa and morcilla, which is a Spanish blood sausage, and then a great selection of Belgian Trappist ales. So if you can imagine, you know, a nice spicy kielbasa and a Trappist ale, that's, you know, The Cannibal in Culver City is a good place to go. Oh, a place I really like is The Park near Dodger Stadium. Chef Josh Siegel has created this small, beautiful, inexpensive neighborhood restaurants where the quality is incredibly high. He does a prefix and he'll do like a hot Italian sausage with polenta and mushroom and pepper ragu, like on a Tuesday prefix night. You know, the place is full because people respond to this kind of direct, robust kind of food in a great neighborhood restaurant. And there's an entire English tradition of sausage, let's not forget. So Brendan Collins at Birch, you know, Sunday morning, he'll give you eggs and bangers. Of course, most people go for the incredible roast beef and Yorkshire pudding he does. But there is that. And of course, speaking of England, Ye Olde King's Head in Santa Monica, they'll do a proper bangers and mash and peas. I mean, I guess the dish absolutely requires peas in the English tradition.
What about newer places like Wurstküche and Soul Sausage?
Soul Sausage Kitchen is fantastic. I really like their sausages. There's one on Mississippi and there's one downtown. What I really like is that how they're giving it a Korean flavor and they do a kalbi pork sausage with a kimchi relish. It's not cabbage kimchi, is like a radish ground very fine. What it does to a freshly grilled sausage, and I warm bun is fantastic.
What about in the more southern parts of the city?
Harold and Bell's, which is the classic place, has been there since 1969 on West Jefferson Boulevard. They've redone it. It was always fantastic, but it's had this overhaul in the last year that makes it really like a destination place that plays great jazz. And the sausage I had in their gumbo was just fantastic. You know, the dark roux, half a blue crab, and of course a side of rice. And then, but the sausage, you understand sausage, it's a beef sausage, and it almost has a texture of a blood pudding. And as your spoon is going through this gumbo that's full of all these great things, the sausage absolutely shines. And they're open for lunch and dinner, of course, and they serve carafes of voodoo sangria. So, and you can watch the Super Bowl there. So
there you go. We're firing on all cylinders. That's Los Angeles Magazine restaurant critic Patrick Q. See pictures of his favorite links, some brats and wieners as well in L.A., on our Facebook page. Just search for KCRW's Good Food. Now, with an antidote to all that meat, we turn to our favorite food critic. That would be Jonathan Gold. So, Jonathan, where are you taking us this week?
Irvin, the new vegan restaurant in Santa Monica. As a restaurant critic in Los Angeles, I often find myself at vegan restaurants, and I am rarely as happy with my meal as I might be. I don't like things that are pretending to be other things so much.
Yeah.
But Irvin is the restaurant from Nick Irvin, who we talked about when he was at St. Martha a couple years ago. I wouldn't say it happens to be vegan because it's definitely vegan, but it's the way that a chef obsessed with vegetables might look at vegan food as opposed to somebody who's vegan because of moral reasons.
So share with us some of the things you like the most.
I like the fried sunchokes, which were super crisp and sauced with something that was a little bit between a romesco from northern Spain and ketchup. There were deep-fried dates that were savory in their way, and they probably would pass as an analog to the bacon-wrapped dates that everybody's been doing them since Suzanne Gowen introduced them 1,000 years ago.
Are they filled with anything?
They're lightly pickled. There's a little bit of curry. There's pine nuts around. They're kind of tasty. Another dish, you bite down into something that looks like donut holes, you know, the kind that you would get at, like, Winchell's. Inside, there's a sour dark puree of sauerkraut and smoked apples that sort of, like, jets across the table.
That sounds delicious, actually.
Yeah. There's a lot of vegetable cooking going on right now. I mean, you have PYT, which we talked about recently, that is mostly vegetables. We have Destroyer that's mostly vegetables with the perverse steak tartare on the menu. You have a lot of chefs looking to guys like Alain Passard and like the way that, say, Red Zepi cooks vegetables as opposed to everything being from the moosewood.
Yeah, it's not hippie.
It's not hippie anymore. But in a certain way, you are seeing some of the things from hippie cooking coming in that weren't in vegetable dishes when it was just mainstream, I guess. So you see sprouts and you see broths made with brewer's yeast. And you see people putting cauliflower on things instead of cheese. You know, I keep thinking that it's not going to be that long before, you know, people like some of my friends who I refer to as obligate carnivores, because that's all they'll eat, like sit in like pour through the menus looking for a scrap of flesh the way that vegetarians used to look for something that wasn't a steamed vegetable plate.
That's so interesting. Okay, give us some more highlights from here.
If you remember the dish of mixed cabbages in yeast broth at St. Martha, which was one of my favorite dishes there, there is something pretty similar here with mushrooms and like twisty strands of pasta. There's an actually delicious veggie burger, though they don't call it a veggie burger. It's just beer-battered tofu on a bun with pickles and slaw, and it drips like a good hamburger. And there's sort of a meatiness that gives it not necessarily a meaty taste, but there's a lot of umami.
There. Yeah.
And so you're having like a vegan burger, but it's not a substitute burger. It's a thing on its own.
That's what you want to see, right?
Yeah. a lot of restaurants in town are doing, you know, roasted carrots with yogurt. Irvin uses a coconut sorbet, and suddenly it becomes more of a Thai dish than sort of like a Northern European dish. There's a little bit of sriracha sauce and a handful of torn Thai herbs. It's a nice dish. There's a black-eyed pea stew with braised collard greens and Korean tteokbokki, those cylinders of rice cake that you see on street corners. They sizzle, they become super crisp where they hit the grill, and they're served in a kimchi-flavored sauce. He doesn't call it tteokbokki. He calls them Korean gnocchi, but you sort of get the idea.
Which I think is a good title.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting menu.
Again, I liked it because he lets vegetables taste like themselves instead of analogs of things you aren't supposed to eat. It's about what's put in instead of what's left out. The thing that I didn't love as much were the desserts. There's a meringue made out of aquafaba, which is the water left over from cooking chickpeas. And you can whip it into something that looks very much like meringue, but it's not a meringue.
See, I've had aquafaba meringues that were totally meringues.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe they just need to work on the execution.
Yeah.
Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, is dining at Irvin this week in Santa Monica. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. In a minute, we get some new ideas for what to do with all those carrots you're seeing at grocery stores and markets. Don't go anywhere. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Nothing says winter like carrots. And when it's cold, they are so, so sweet.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're talking now with David Koh, who's the chef owner of Little Fatty, which is a restaurant on Venice Boulevard, right at Grandview. You're looking for, you said, carrots, root vegetables. Tell us why you're so enamored with carrots at this time of year.
Carrots are a great fall and winter item. We pickle them. We actually cut them into little julienne strips, and we pickle them, and it brings balance to a lot of our dishes.
And when you say julienne, do you peel them too?
Yeah, we definitely peel them. We give them a wash, and we peel them, and then, you know, we cut them into little matchsticks. So for the dish, it comes with it on a noodle dish. Jajangmyeon is like a traditional Asian noodle. There's two different kinds, I guess. There's a Beijing kind, a Korean kind, actually three, and then there's a Taiwanese kind. I'm sure there's more, but that's all I know of. The Korean version is mostly just fermented black bean paste, and then there's an Asian version where it's actually made out of something called tianmian jiang. It means sweet flour sauce. So it's actually like flour paste that's actually been caramelized into like a black paste. So we use a combination of both because I did some research and I did some tasting. I took the best of both worlds, and then we use the fermented black bean paste with the sweet flour sauce. We cook it like an Asian bolognese. The secret to a good bolognese is to caramelize something low and slow and develop that fond and like scrape the bottom and caramelize the pork, the onions, and then we actually fold in the paste and we caramelize the paste like tomato paste, as you would as a bolognese.
And this is all a topping on noodles?
Yeah, so that's the sauce. Yeah. We caramelize pork, onions, ginger, garlic with black bean paste, the sweet flour sauce, black vinegar, and we serve it with fresh noodles, wheat noodles, like a little squared spaghetti, so it's like really al dente. And then to balance all that heaviness and richness, that's where the fresh cucumber that we shave into ribbons on a mandolin. We top it with the pickled carrots to add some acidity and more crunch, and then pickled chilies also, and green onions. When you eat it, you take two forks and you toss it together, and then you get that blend of like hot noodles and the richness of the sauce and like the cold cucumber and refreshing crunch of all the julienne vegetables, and then this acidity from the pickled carrots.
Is zhajangmyeon something that Taiwanese eat every day? Is it a comfort food?
I think it's a comfort food. Every household kind of makes a little different, but definitely like noodles and a rich pork sauce and like some pickled vegetables is totally typical Taiwanese. Mm-hmm. A lot of Taiwanese cooking is like, you know, really satisfying soul food. My mom used to cook, I guess, home-cooked Taiwanese food. My mom had a great influence on me, and like, you know, some of our recipes are based on her and my grandmother's cooking, but definitely like through my travels and through my education and like working in different kitchens, you know, I put my own little spin on it.
And tell us about the name Little Fatty.
Yeah, so growing up, my parents and relatives used to call me Xiao Peng, which means little fatty in Chinese. Yeah, so, I mean, growing up, it was like kind of like a term of endearment, and now it kind of coincides with our philosophy. Our restaurant's kind of fun. It's like tongue-in-cheek. We take our stuff serious, but it also tastes good, and it's affordable.
David, thank you so much. That sounds absolutely delicious. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
We're talking now with Paul Thurston, who people are familiar with at McGrath Family Farm here at the Wednesday Market. You have orange carrots, white carrots, I guess purple carrots, red carrots. Tell us about the different kinds of carrots and why is it that people will prefer orange for certain dishes?
Well, we do have the three varieties today. We have the orange ones, which are knots, French knots. Those are just a great baby carrot, nice and sweet and tender, real tender meat. The yellow is called the Yellowstone. They're a little bit more firm carrot, but just as delicious. And then, of course, the purple haze is our purple carrot. There's a couple of varieties of purple, but we prefer the purple haze. And it has actually an orange interior and with a purple skin that I believe remains after you've cooked them. But, yeah, we've done really well with these three varieties. They're pretty much a standard for us for 20 years.
Is this the season now for carrots?
You know, it can be. It is. I mean, I believe spring is your most optimum of all. But for us, we have a mild Mediterranean-type climate there in Camarillo. So we grow just about everything year-round. That can be grown year-round, we grow it year-round. Some people, I think, are maybe out in the hills of Fresno or Bakersfield or whatnot. It's too cold. For the carrots, but for us, very good time for us.
And the size you harvest them, I mean, you have them in those bunches, and they're sort of on I'd say four to six inches.
Yeah. We used to always pick full-size carrots, and then we began catering to the restaurants, and they prefer the small baby to medium-sized carrots. So that's how we pick them all the time now, and the general public has switched over. And they prefer them smaller rather than the big gulps, the big giant.
Big gulp. So we're going to be expecting to see these three varieties of carrots. The nant is the one so sugary sweet that you always eat raw. The other two, can they be eaten raw or are they more for cooking?
You know, they can all be eaten raw. Yeah, I would say that the nants are always good raw. The purple most of the time are good raw, and the yellows sometimes good raw, yeah, but better cooked, yeah.
Okay. How do you like to cook your carrots?
You know, I like to roast them. I just think that's the best. I'll get a whole bunch of different root vegetables, some rutabagas, beets, even potatoes and different carrots, and cut them up and toss them with a little butter and garlic, olive oil, and let them roast, yeah.
Well, it's nice that you have all this at your disposal. You can walk out in the field and just pick your dinner and pick your lunch, and it's great.
It is. I do it every day. It's grazing, what I call it. Just go out and test everything, the pea tendrils, the lettuce, the peas, carrots, pull them out. But, yeah, I get to do that every day. It's a really nice thing.
All right. Okay. Well, Paul, you and McGrath Farm have been at this market, I think, as long as I have. It's always great to have you here. You're certified organic, and your stuff is super tasty. And thanks so much for talking to us.
All right. Yeah, you're welcome.
For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Next, we travel to the capital of Peru to meet the man behind one of the world's best restaurants. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
I live in Lima, by the sea. Then we have the Andes, la Cordillera de los Andes, and then we have the Amazon. But it's just not a flat Amazon. It's just an Amazon with altitudes, which creates different microclimates too. Lots of them.
That's Chef Virgilio Martinez. His Lima restaurant, Central, has been voted one of the best places to eat in the world by the British magazine Restaurant. The menu's an exploration of Peru's many altitudes, ecosystems, and native ingredients. Martinez recently published a cookbook that's named after his restaurant. In the book, it says that 10% of all global species of plants and animals are found there. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's something to really defend.
Yeah, it really changed the way we start seeing our food, our cooking style.
You know, it's interesting because we're in a time where so many highly skilled and well-traveled chefs are turning somewhat inward to cook from their own lands. But your locality is just so much more complex.
That's right. That what we do is not a local cuisine, because people will say like, oh yeah, you are doing Peruvian, so you are like 100% of the ingredients that you're using are from Peru, so you are very local. And I say like, I'm local when I'm in the Andes. I'm local when I'm in different parts of the Amazonia. I'm local in the rainforest, in the rivers. I'm local by the sea. Everywhere we go, we find different ecosystems. And how can we connect people through food?
As one example of that, talk about the huampo.
Yeah, one day I was just doing preps. I was mise en place in the kitchen, and this woman was just talking about, she was from the Amazon, from the Selva Central, which is the jungle, in the center of the jungle. And she was telling me the story about a bark that has some medicinal uses and that has this natural gel. And we're like so, at one point, so obsessed about stop using any different powders that don't belong to our ecosystems, that for me, when I want to achieve a new texture, I want to achieve that texture from something natural, and something natural coming from that same place where I'm using those same ingredients.
Could you describe the dish that's in the book that you use it for?
Yeah, we make a huampo gelatina. So we use the huampo gel just to make it a bit solid, the emulsion of amashua, which is a tuber, and then from some Amazonian herbs.
And when you described the first shipment she got from her family, you said it was almost as big as she was.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't stop laughing for an hour and make jokes about that.
In order to do what you're doing, to shift the focus of creating dishes from being ingredient-driven maybe to being ecosystem-driven, you have to do a lot of research. And so you have a research arm called the Mater Iniciativa.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a bit about that?
You know, we start Mater Iniciativa because we had this need of knowledge. And my sister happened to be, she's a physician. And I asked her like, hey, I need some structure here for the restaurant. And we need to get some more knowledge and we need to work with different disciplines. And after 1 year, we start to work with different anthropologists and botanists and biologists and architects, painters, different artists. They are joining us, and it's quite fascinating because people get inspiration in different disciplines. It all starts with nature and food, but then it goes to another level.
Talk a little bit about the Incan terraces.
Every single terrace, they have the shape of circles and they have different microclimates. The pre-Incas used to do, they were just testing different crops in different terraces.
So they would test the different crops in different altitudes.
Yeah, in different altitudes. So that really inspired me to start a menu based on altitudes. When I saw these terraces, I saw that they were planting quinoas in one terrace. They were planting ocas and mashuas, tubers in some other terraces. They were planting potatoes in another terrace, corn, herbs, fruits. So when they kind of understood what was the best microclimate or altitude, they could go just to plant them in a wide, big space in the mountains, in the Andes, in different altitudes.
Could you describe one of your dishes, the diversity of maíz?
That's a dish very colorful because when we go to get the harvest of maíz, the corn, we see different corns like blue, red, yellow, different textures, different sizes. And we make a snack, kind of a ceviche of yellow corn. Then we make a dough with blue corn, another dough with red corn. Then we use another corn called cancha to make a cracker. We use some of the stems, you know, to smoke. And we use the whole corn. And even we cover, because we find clay over there, we cover the corn with clay to cook the corn inside the little clay oven.
How did you go about finding the correct clay?
That's the knowledge that we get from locals. We go and we ask, and we love listening to people. And all this knowledge coming from pre-Incas time and Peru from people is just fascinating. So in some other region, the Altiplano, they have edible clay, which is called Chaco. And in that place where the Chaco grows, it grows cacao. We get coca leaves. We got different herbs.
Wow. Do you have a signature dish at the restaurant?
Actually, we don't, you know, because we keep changing dishes. And because about the explorations that we do, we get new ideas and new perceptions. I think when we talk about the whole a signature dish, we should be talking about the whole experience as Central, which is like 16 courses with different altitudes and different ecosystems and different ideas and different messages. I think that's the main message.
Your early years were spent as a professional skateboarder.
Yeah.
How does it link to the world of becoming a chef?
When I was skating, I was very competitive. I wanted to be very creative. And all these things are happening in the kitchen now. We compete, but we share too. And I think as a skater, it hasn't changed that much. And at this point, I have so much gratitude about, you know, finding this job as a cook and get inspiration from different people and working with my team and having these wonderful producers and living in this country where I get to see different stuff and I get to know different cultures.
Virgilio is going to be on the next season of Chef's Table that will air on Netflix on February 17th. Find that recipe for Diversidad de Maíz on the Good Food blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. That is it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show at kcrw.com, on KCRW's mobile app, or on any other mobile app you use for podcasting. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine, Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.